It's Tuesday, the 17th of June, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman, in Flagstaff, bringing you these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. OpenAI, Microsoft tensions are reaching a boiling point. Tehran signals readiness to renew diplomacy. And young grads looking for work confront employment crisis. Our first article by Berber Jin, OpenAI, Microsoft tensions are reaching a boiling point. Startup frustrated with its partner has discussed making antitrust complaints. Tensions between OpenAI and Microsoft over the future of their famed AI partnership are flaring up. OpenAI wants to loosen Microsoft's grip on its AI products and computing resources and secure the tech giant's blessing for its conversion into a for-profit company. Microsoft's approval of the conversion is key to OpenAI's ability to raise more money and go public. But the negotiations have been so difficult that in recent weeks, OpenAI's executives have discussed what they view as a nuclear option, accusing Microsoft of anti-competitive behavior during their partnership, people familiar with the matter said. That effort could involve seeking federal regulatory review of the terms of the contract for potential violations of antitrust law, as well as a public campaign, the people said. Such a move could threaten the company's six-year-old relationship, widely seen as one of the most successful partnerships in tech history. For years, Microsoft fueled OpenAI's rise in exchange for early access to its technology. But the two sides have since turned into competitors, making it more difficult to find common ground. We have a long-term, productive partnership that has delivered amazing AI tools for everyone, representatives for the two companies said in a joint statement. Talks are ongoing, and we are optimistic we will continue to build together for years to come. OpenAI and Microsoft are at a standoff over the terms of the startup's $3 billion acquisition of the coding startup GitHub Copilot that competes with OpenAI. OpenAI doesn't want Microsoft to have access to Windsurf's intellectual property. OpenAI has a content licensing deal with the Wall Street Journal's parent company, News Corp. The companies continue to be at odds over how much of OpenAI Microsoft would own if it converts into a public benefit corporation. Microsoft is currently asking for a larger stake in the new company than OpenAI is willing to give, people familiar with the matter said. OpenAI has to complete the conversion by the end of the year or it risks losing $20 billion in funding. Under the Biden administration, the Federal Trade Commission opened a broad antitrust investigation into Microsoft last year. It also examined Microsoft's investment in OpenAI alongside other big tech investments into AI more than a year ago. Microsoft first invested $1 billion into OpenAI in 2019. Under the current contract, the tech giant has the exclusive right to sell OpenAI software tools through its Azure cloud and has preferred access to the startup's technology. Microsoft is also supposed to be OpenAI's only computer provider, though it allowed the startup to create its own data center project, Stargate, last year. The two now compete on products ranging from consumer chatbots to AI tools for businesses. Last year, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella hired a rival of OpenAI CEO Sam Altman's, who launched a secret effort to build models for Microsoft. The startup is trying to renegotiate elements of that deal alongside its planned conversion. It wants to join with other cloud providers so it can sell its technology to more customers and access additional computing resources. Microsoft, meanwhile, wants access to OpenAI's technology even after the startup declares its models have achieved human-like intelligence, which would end the current partnership. That level of sophistication known as artificial general intelligence is a subject of fierce debate among technology executives. Some believe it is possible and imminent, while others believe it is far off or potentially out of reach, and that AI improvements are likely to be incremental. And that's OpenAI, Microsoft tensions are reaching a boiling point. Our next headline, Tehran signals readiness to renew diplomacy. Iran says it wants nuclear talks as long as the U.S. stays out of conflict with Israel. This is by Summer Saeed, Benoit Forson, and Anat Pelid, Dubai. Iran has been urgently signaling that it seeks an end to hostilities and resumption of talks over its nuclear program, sending messages to Israel and the U.S. through Arab intermediaries, Middle Eastern and European officials said. In the midst of a ferocious Israeli air campaign, Tehran has told Arab officials it would be open to returning to the negotiating table as long as the U.S. doesn't join the attack, the officials said. Iran also passed messages to Israel saying it is in the interest of both sides to keep the violence contained. But with Israeli warplanes able to fly freely over the capital and Iranian counterattacks inflicting minimal damage, Israeli leaders have little incentive to halt their assault before doing more to destroy Iran's nuclear sites and further weaken the theocratic government's hold on power. Israeli strikes have killed key military leaders, including much of the top echelon of Iran's air force, leaving Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei increasingly isolated. But the impact on nuclear facilities has been modest, and some analysts said it could take a long air war to get the results Israel wants. Israel on Monday struck buildings belonging to an Iranian state-owned media company in Tehran during what appeared to be a live broadcast after the Israeli military said residents and workers in that part of the capital should leave. Israel said earlier it killed four senior Iranian intelligence officials in a strike on the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps' headquarters. More ships capable of intercepting ballistic missiles will head to the eastern Mediterranean Sea in the coming days and weeks, U.S. officials said. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel has said the attacks will continue until Iran's nuclear program and ballistic missiles are destroyed. He's also said regime change isn't a goal, but could be a result given the Iranian leadership's weakness. Israeli officials have said the military has prepared at least 2 weeks of strikes. On Saturday, President Emmanuel Macron of France told his Iranian counterpart to return swiftly to the negotiating table to reach an agreement. And Arab leaders have called for an end to the fighting. President Trump resisted a military campaign for much of the year, but has since cheered on Israel's attacks and said Iran missed a chance to cut a deal. They'd like to talk, but they should have done that before, Trump said on Monday in Canada. They should talk, and they should talk immediately before it's too late. Responding to Trump's comments, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich of Israel said on Monday that the U.S. president isn't telling Israel to rein in its military campaign, which Smotrich said hadn't reached its midway point. Iran has told some Arab officials it won't unilaterally stop fighting and will continue to respond to Israeli attacks, aiming to restore deterrence. Securing a pause could give Iran breathing room to regroup and for pressure to build internationally against Israel's campaign. It would also be a win for Tehran to keep the U.S. from bringing its bunker-busting military capabilities into the fight. Tehran appears to be betting that Israel can't afford to get stuck in a war of attrition and would have to seek a diplomatic solution eventually, Arab diplomats who've spoken with the Iranians said. Iranian officials said they thought Israel lacked a clear exit strategy and would need U.S. help to do meaningful damage to targets such as the Fordow uranium enrichment facility, which is buried under a mountain. The Iranians know the U.S. is supporting Israel in its defense, and they're sure the U.S. is supporting Israel logistically, an Arab official said, but they want guarantees the U.S. won't join the attacks. On Monday, the White House said the U.S. isn't joining Israel's attacks on Iran, pushing back on online speculation otherwise. American forces are maintaining their defensive posture, and that has not changed, spokesman Alex Pfeiffer wrote on X. A Pentagon spokesman, Sean Parnell, posted a similar comment. Trump signed on to an agreement by the group of seven countries about Iran that called for peace and stability in the Middle East after resisting attempts Monday by the Canadian and European officials at the Leaders' Summit in Alberta. In this context, we affirm that Israel has a right to defend itself. We reiterate our support for the security of Israel. We also affirm the importance of the protection of civilians, a statement said, adding, Iran is a principal source of regional instability and terror. The head of the United Nations Atomic Agency on Monday said the centrifuges in one of the underground halls at Natanz enrichment site might have been destroyed altogether, potentially meaning all of the previously operating machines for enriching uranium at the massive underground part of the site had been taken out. Iran has told Arab officials it could accelerate its nuclear program and expand the scope of the war if there are no prospects of resuming talks with the U.S. There's no indication Iran is ready to make new concessions in nuclear talks, the Arab intermediary said. The diplomatic effort led by the Trump administration was stalled over Iran's refusal to stop enriching uranium before the talks were cut short by Israel's attacks last week. Before the attack, a senior Israeli official said an end to enrichment was the minimum Israel could accept from Iran. Israel and Gulf states are also concerned with Iran's support for regional militias and its ballistic missile program, which theoretically could come back up for discussion if Iran is backed into a sufficiently deep corner. And that's Tehran signals readiness to renew diplomacy. Our next article, young grads looking for work confront employment crisis. This is by Justin LaHart and Teping Chen. The U.S. labor market is holding steady despite extraordinary economic upheaval, but it is a bad time to be a job seeker, especially if you're young. Recent college and high school graduates are facing an employment crisis. The overall national unemployment rate remains around 4%, but for new college graduates looking for work, it's much higher, 6.6% over the past 12 months, ending in May. That's about the highest level in a decade, excluding the pandemic unemployment spike and up from 6% for the 12-month period a year earlier. That rate, based on data from the Labor Department, applies to people ages 20 to 24 looking for work who have at least a bachelor's degree. This group is mostly people 21 to 24, since few people graduate college sooner. Young graduates typically face a higher unemployment rate than their counterparts who've been in the workforce longer, but the gap is growing wider between older workers and the young. Those ages 35 to 44 with bachelor's degrees had a 2.2% unemployment rate over the past 12 months, though that was up from 1.8% over the prior period. This follows an April report from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York saying labor market conditions for recent college graduates deteriorated noticeably in the first quarter of this year, even for young college graduates who have been in the workforce longer. They found unemployment among college grads ages 22 to 27 averaged 5.8% in the first 3 months of this year when President Trump's on-again, off-again tariff policies were just starting to rattle businesses and consumer confidence. Growing gap. Moreover, the gap between the unemployment rate for these young graduates and the broader population became its widest in about 35 years of comparable New York Fed analyses. The culprit, economists said, is a general slowdown in hiring. That hasn't really hurt people who already have jobs because layoffs, too, have remained low. But it's made it much harder for people who don't have work to find employment. That includes everyone looking for work, but especially recent grads trying to land that first big post-school job. Businesses are hunkering down, and that creates a challenge for young workers entering the labor market for the first time, said Corey Stahl, economist at job site Indeed. With employers turning more cautious on hires, they're less inclined to gamble on workers with thinner resumes or skill sets, he said. Recent Lehigh University graduate Kirby Child, 22 years old, has spent the past several months hunting for work in fields such as health communications. She keeps running into the same challenge. Even companies filling entry-level roles are asking for 3 to 5 years of professional experience. I'll think, I could be good at this, but I haven't been given a shot yet, said Child, who lives in Potomac, Maryland. I don't have those 3 to 5 years of experience, and it feels really hard to get that. Entry-level hiring has fallen by 17% since April 2019, according to data from LinkedIn. Since the pandemic, hiring has risen in healthcare, construction, and education, but weakened in other areas that have traditionally snapped up many college graduates, including tech and financial services, said Corey Katenga, LinkedIn's head of economics for the Americas. Graduates who flock to fields such as computer science now have far more competition, just as companies are increasingly leaning on artificial intelligence to perform low-level tasks that a new employee might have done. But a general hiring slowdown is far and away the driving force behind graduates' often fruitless job searches, said Guy Berger, director of economic research at the Burning Glass Institute think tank. What's more, most of the college and high school students tossing their mortar boards into the air this month and last month aren't even in the unemployment statistics yet. One reason that the national unemployment level managed to stay low in May is that fewer people are in the workforce. That could mean frustrated job seekers stopped looking, just as more young grads are starting their searches. Zara Anwar, Child's friend and a fellow Spring Lehigh grad, who has a bachelor's degree in cognitive science, struggled to find employment while applying for 60 jobs. She finally received an offer this spring to work as a data analyst for a tech marketing company, but her start date has been delayed twice, most recently to August 2025. I worry for myself. I can only hope my job actually does start in August, but I truly don't know, Anwar, 21, said. Degrees do help. The environment is even rougher for people without degrees. High school graduates ages 18 to 19 with no college averaged an unemployment rate of 14.5% over the past 12 months. That's up from 13.3% over the prior 12-month period. The Labor Department reported earlier this month that there were about 1.5 million fewer hires in the first 4 months of this year than in the first 4 months of last year. In Greenwich, Connecticut, graduating high school senior Graydon Robbie said he has been shocked by his struggle to land a summer job. Robbie, 18, who's college-bound in the fall, has been applying since February for seasonal gigs with employers such as Home Depot, a movie theater, and fast food joints. My whole life, I figured if I needed a minimum wage job, I'd apply and get one, and it wouldn't be this hard, Robbie said. But it's super difficult. Jack Juliana, 22, who graduated last month from Fordham University with a bachelor's degree in finance, said he has already applied to hundreds of jobs. Many prospective employers never responded or sent him rejection notices after a matter of hours. He recently decided to spend a few weeks backpacking in Spain before returning home to stay with his parents in Seagirt, New Jersey. Right now, I'm pretending employment doesn't exist, Juliana said. That's young grads looking for work confront employment crisis. Let's turn now to the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal for this article by Seth Cropsey. Israel hands America an opportunity in the Mideast. Finishing off the Iranian nuclear program would enhance the U.S. position with Russia and China. The U.S. faces a consequential choice: take advantage of Israel's audacious attacks on Iran to shepherd a new Middle East into existence, or allow this transformational strategic opportunity to pass. By giving Israel the time it needs to destroy Iranian military capacity, Washington can seize a strategic advantage in Europe and Asia. Operation Rising Lion is a prime example of Israeli strategic culture. Israel doesn't adapt well to fluid situations, which it must react on the fly. The October 7, 2023 attacks are a case in point. The Jewish state was frozen for much of the attacks, with the individual heroism, not strategic response capacity, driving back Hamas. But when Israel has the time and capacity to plan an operation down to the smallest detail, the results are spectacular. Whether the pager walkie-talkie attack that crippled Hezbollah's leadership, The September 2024 commando raid against an Iranian missile facility in northwestern Syria, the 2007 attack on Syria's nuclear site, or the 1981 strike against Iraq's Osirek reactor. Rising Lion is on a completely different scale from those earlier operations. Israel sequenced its opening move, simultaneously disabling Iran's remaining air defenses and radars, killing high-ranking Iranian military leaders, and hitting Iranian missile silos. Subsequent strike waves began against nuclear and conventional military targets. Israel has crippled Iran's command structures, dented its missile arsenal, and substantially damaged its nuclear weapons program, hitting key sites in Isfahan, Arak, Natanz, and Parshin. Israel also killed several Iranian nuclear scientists and leaders involved with the nuclear program, extinguishing crucial institutional and bureaucratic knowledge and creating more hurdles between enrichment and weaponization. If Rising Lion ended tonight, Israel would have set Iran's nuclear program back by 1 to 3 years. Yet, the crown jewel in Iran's nuclear program, the Fordow fuel enrichment plant, remains, housing several thousand centrifuges and buried 80 to 100 yards underground. The facility would allow Iran to reconstitute a fissile material stockpile, even if other elements of its nuclear infrastructure are badly damaged. Israel has two options to destroy Fordow. It can drop a large number of 1,000-pound and 5,000-pound bunker busters using its understanding of the facility's design to maximize damage and dig through layers of soil, rock, and concrete. This would take several strike waves, increasing the risk that Iran's remaining air defenses might trap Israeli fighters. Alternatively, Israel could stage a commando raid, physically sabotaging the site with profound risks to personnel. Its most natural option is instead an American strike on Fordow. The U.S. developed the GBU-57A/B Massive Ordnance Penetrator, or MOP, a 30,000-pound bunker buster. Depending on the facility design and penetration angle, it would likely take between 3 and 8 MOPs to cripple Fordow. Each B-2 stealth bomber can carry 2 MOPs. The U.S. could conceivably mix MOPs and lighter weapons to use B-52s, B-1s, or stealth fighters in the strike package. The point, putting aside the technical specifics, is that the U.S. has a one-shot opportunity to finish Iran's nuclear ambitions, one that would take no more than a few airstrikes. This would also trigger regime destabilization. Iranian strategy stood on the axis of resistance and the nuclear and missile program. Rather than building a conventional army, Iran invested in a proxy network enabled by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps' Quds Force, which would wage constant warfare against the U.S. and Israel and the Gulf Arab states without exposing Iran to direct attack. Concurrently, Iran would develop nuclear weapons and alongside them an enormous missile and drone arsenal, allowing it to conduct long-range strikes for weeks during a major war, overwhelming Gulf or Israeli air defenses. Today, the axis is in tatters, with Bashar al-Assad's Syria destroyed, Hezbollah crippled, and Hamas and other Palestinian organizations shattered. Rising Lion damaged the nuclear and missile arsenal. A strike on Fordow would not only destroy the program, it would be the culmination of the Revolutionary Guards and Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's greatest fear that Israel and the U.S. would act against Iran before it had either nuclear weapons or a large enough missile arsenal to deter war. Eliminating the nuclear program would open the road to the Islamic Republic's collapse. Absent proxies, nuclear potential, and a missile arsenal, Iran would lose its leverage over the Gulf states and its coercive potential against Israel and in the Levant. The regime's internal structure survives through coercion, cultivated ideological loyalty to symbols of the Islamic Republic's tenacity, namely the nuclear program, and access to black market patronage. crippling the nuclear program and damaging security infrastructure throughout the country, as Israel is doing with attacks on intelligence and security elements, would create room for unrest and fragmentation within the Iranian security state, making revolution possible. Even if the regime doesn't implode, a weak, vulnerable Iran provides an overwhelmingly strengthened position to the U.S. in its struggle against the Eurasian axis. The U.S. can pressure Iran into cutting oil exports on Russia's behalf, eliminate the Caspian Sea route for evading sanctions, and prevent Iran's use as a technological smuggling hub. Iran's illicit oil tanker fleet is also essential to Russian evasion of energy sanctions. Without Tehran's backing, this network becomes much weaker. China would stand to lose much more than Europe from a disruption in Iranian oil exports. If they were taken offline fully, the Gulf states could fill the gap, albeit slowly, but only because of American support. The U.S. could finally establish a stranglehold on oil export to Asia, thus providing significant leverage over China. The U.S. has a unique opportunity to gain a potentially decisive advantage against Russia and China. To seize it, Mr. Trump would strengthen the U.S. security immeasurably by allowing Israel to finish the job against Iran, if necessary, applying American power to this end as well. Mr. Cropsey, our author, is a president of Yorktown Institute. He served as a naval officer and as a deputy undersecretary of the Navy, and is author of Mayday and Sea Blindness. And that's Israel Hands America an Opportunity in the Mideast, an article from the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona programming, such as the Wall Street Journal, at a time of your choosing or as it streams by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app from the Apple App Store for your iPad or iPhone or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And finally, you can also listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot or Echo. Let's turn now to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal for these headlines. Kering taps Renault for next CEO. Vice hires veteran of NBC parent to lead comeback. And Chinese stock scams lure investors. Turning to that first article by Nick Kostov, Kering taps Renault for next CEO. François-Henri Pinault has been candid about the need for bold action. Paris. François-Henri Pinault, the billionaire heir who spent two decades transforming Kering into a luxury powerhouse, is stepping back as chief executive officer, hoping an auto industry veteran can pull Gucci and Saint Laurent out of a slump. Kering named departing Renault chief Luca De Meo as CEO, ending months of speculation about a leadership change at the French fashion group. Pinault, who took charge in 2005 from his father, oversaw Kering's shift from a retail conglomerate to a focused luxury player. The move paid off during the boom years, but has since run into trouble. Now, Pinault said, Kering is ready for a new stage in its development. He praised DeMeo's experience at the helm of an international listed group, his sharp understanding of brands, and his sense of a strong and respectful corporate culture. DeMeo will take the helm on September 15th, subject to shareholder approval, Kering said. His last day at Renault will be July 15th. Pinault will remain chairman. For Kering, the move represents a gamble at a precarious moment. Once a leader in European luxury, the group lags behind rivals such as Hermès and Bernard Arnault's LVMH by a widening margin. Gucci, Kering's biggest brand by revenue, stumbled in China and lost ground to many competitors. Saint Laurent has been weighed down by a smaller wholesale business and a tougher U.S. market. Kering's market value drops about 70% from a high 3 years ago. DeMeo has a titanic challenge ahead of him, said Luca Solca, analyst at Bernstein. Investors will need to hear what it is that DeMeo plans to do and digest how soon his plans can be realized. Kering shares rose 12% in Paris on Monday after reports of the likely appointment emerged, while Renault stock fell 8.7%. Pinault, who met DeMeo a few months ago, told analysts he'd been laying the groundwork to split the roles of chairman and CEO for a number of years, accelerating in recent months. He brought in two headhunters to help identify a successor. In addition to retaining the chairman's role, Pinault and his family hold a 42% shareholding and about 60% of the company's voting rights. The holding accounts for the bulk of the family's fortune, estimated at just under $20 billion. With the 58-year-old DeMeo, Kering is betting that an executive who revitalized car brands can do the same for handbags and clothing. DeMeo has more than three decades of experience in the automotive industry, building a reputation as a brand builder and marketer. He helped turn Fiat's modern 500 into a cultural icon, carved out Seat's sporty Cupra line, and refocused Renault by slimming its model range and boosting profitability in hybrids and electric vehicles. DeMeo is no stranger to craftsmanship. He collects intricate Swiss watches and counts Pietro Beccari, CEO of LVMH's Louis Vuitton brand, as a friend, a bond cemented over regular paddle matches. Still, running a car maker and leading a luxury conglomerate demand different skills. Success in autos relies heavily on industrial scale, efficiency, and engineering excellence. High fashion depends more on narrative, cultural cachet, and the unpredictable chemistry between designers and audiences. A luxury leader must be able to manage a stable of creative directors, handle viral social media moments, and safeguard brand mystique. Reviving underperforming brands has become more complex and costly, with investors wary of turnaround stories and consumers gravitating toward established leaders, said Thomas Chauvet, luxury analyst at Citi. He said Kering faces a long road to restore momentum at Gucci and Saint Laurent and secure steady growth and cash flow. Pinault has been candid about the need for bold action and has shaken up Kering over the past 2 years. He named two deputy CEOs and became more involved in brand elevation strategies, which aim to ensure that every action taken in areas from real estate to marketing and product development builds the brand's long-term standing. At Gucci, which made up almost half of sales and more than 60% of core profit last year, a new CEO took over in the fall. A new creative director, Demna Gazalia of Balenciaga, is due to start in July. And that's Kering Taps Renault for next CEO. Our next article is by Isabella Simonetti. Vice hires veteran of NBC parent to lead comeback. A longtime NBC Universal marketing executive is taking over as chief executive of Vice Media, aiming to build up the company's studio and advertising arms after a tumultuous few years. Vice, the media company founded in 1994 and known for countercultural stories and documentaries, will continue to focus on provocative storytelling, incoming CEO Adam Stotsky said. He also wants storytelling that can build a long-term, profitable, and sustainable media brand in today's landscape. That means more franchises along the lines of its British crime drama Gangs of London and Bama Rush, a documentary on the sorority rite of passage. Fortress Investment Group and other lenders acquired the embattled digital publisher after it filed for bankruptcy in 2023 and pursued a series of cost-cutting efforts. Vice has since refocused its business, shedding assets including Refinery29 and ID Magazine, laying off staff. "A lot of the sort of messy stuff has been cleaned up," said Stotsky, who spent nearly two decades at Comcast-owned NBC Universal, including as president of E! Entertainment and Esquire Network. He also recently worked with private equity-backed entertainment companies, including Religion of Sports, a sports media venture founded by Tom Brady, Michael Strahan, and Gautam Chopra, and Dick Clark Productions, which is now owned by Penske Media Eldridge. Bruce Dixon, who had been Vice's CEO, is leaving the company. Vice's business has several arms: Vice Studios, a scripted and unscripted television production studio; Vice Sports, cable network Vice TV in partnership with A&E; and its advertising operation, which includes Vice commercials and ad agency Virtue. It's going to be really tough for us to compete against Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube for ad revenue, said Michael Lang, Vice's executive chairman and president of Lang Media Group. So we're going to create great content for digital platforms, but we're not going to be in the digital platform business itself. Lang's advice is now profitable, and in the next 3 years, he expects Vice's studio business to be a major driver of the company's revenue. Amy Powell, a former executive at Amazon and Paramount Television, was recently named president of Vice Studios. He said Vice is expanding its Virtue Ads agency's presence in Europe, and he's looking to do more with podcasters in the news space, citing the Shane Smith Has Questions video podcast as an example. Smith is a co-founder of Vice and editor-in-chief of Vice News. Vice also has partnered with Peyton Manning's Omaha Productions on series including Calipari Razor's Edge, about basketball coach John Calipari's first season at the University of Arkansas, and the forthcoming NFL Playback, which looks back at classic games with commentary from celebrities and players, including Manning. And that's Vice hires veteran of NBC parent to lead comeback. Our next article, Chinese Stock Scams Lure Investors, is by Dave Michaels. Braden Lindstrom had only dabbled in investing when he was encouraged by someone impersonating a financial advisor to buy shares of a small Chinese company on the NASDAQ stock market. A few clicks later, he was on his way to being scammed out of $80,000. Lindstrom, a college professor in Utah, invested in Jiayue Global Logistics, a Chinese shipping company whose price rose for months and then crashed 96% just after Americans like him were told to buy it. Wall Street veterans say the pattern has been repeated dozens of times in recent years and feeds on tiny Chinese stocks that are vulnerable to manipulation and easily bought by U.S. investors. Traders and investigators say it's become an epidemic of fraud, frustrating U.S. regulators who typically can't get access to evidence in China, even though the companies market their stocks to investors in the U.S. The Justice Department is now involved with fighting the fraud, which resembles a pump and dump, declaring it a priority of the Trump administration's white-collar enforcement program. The department has stood up a team to identify and root out these bad actors, deter misconduct, and where possible, recover victim funds, said Matthew Gaioletti, the head of the Justice Department's criminal division, using social media. Victims are typically recruited through social media ads or messages on WhatsApp advertising investment advice. Unlike, as in many other online scams, they're told to buy shares of real companies, often obscure Chinese firms that fizzled after going public on U.S. stock exchanges. The investors are duped into believing the company is on the verge of something big, perceptions that are reinforced by short-term gains in share prices engineered through manipulative trading. The sellers are often a ring of traders who bought the stock at much cheaper prices, sometimes directly from the companies, and want to dump it on the unsuspecting victims. Nearly 60 China-based companies conducted initial public offerings on NASDAQ since 2020 that each raised $15 million or less. More than one-third experienced sudden one-day price drops of 50% or more over the past 2 years, according to FactSet data. Another 17 listed companies based in Hong Kong lost half of their market value in a single day. The Financial Industry Regulatory Authority warned in 2022 that small IPOs involving such companies were often a prelude to fraud. Such offerings were supposed to broadly market shares to new investors, but they could instead be placed with insiders or affiliates of the company, and manipulative trading often appeared soon after the IPOs, according to FINRA. "We're seeing this across the landscape," said Brian Smith, a senior vice president for complex investigations at FINRA. One recent criminal case involving China Liberal Education Holdings illustrates how an alleged fraud occurs. China Liberal, which said it ran international study programs for Chinese college students, disclosed in December that it raised almost $21 million from 30 big investors who agreed to buy 160 million shares for about 13 cents each, according to securities filings. But some of those investors were involved in a pump and dump that defrauded 600 victims, according to an indictment issued in March. Seven of the big buyers quickly moved their shares to U.S. brokerage firms. Recruiting investors through Facebook ads and WhatsApp texts, they unloaded over 50 million shares, earning over $480 million, according to the indictment. The Chicago U.S. Attorney's Office in March seized about $214 million, or under half of the allegedly illegal proceeds, after a brokerage firm alerted FINRA of potential fraud. The seven traders, five from Malaysia and two from Taiwan, were charged with wire fraud and securities fraud over their sales of China Liberal Education Holdings stock. NASDAQ suspended China Liberal stock from trading on June the 3rd. Lindstrom, the college professor, is one of five people interviewed by the Wall Street Journal who said they were fooled by ads on Facebook or Instagram that told them to buy Jiayud Global Logistics. The promoters sometimes referred to Jiayud as Cash Cow 5 and said its price would skyrocket after it was acquired by a bigger shipping company, Matson. Lindstrom invested $82,000 in late March. The price touched $8 on April the 1st. After the market closed that day, Jiayud's stock price crashed to under $1. Second swindle. The administrator of Lindstrom's WhatsApp group told him he could make up his losses by buying more shares of a different Chinese company, NASDAQ-listed Liaxiang Education Holding. He didn't fall for the second swindle, but some did. Liaxiang's price fell on April 17th from $23 to $7. It trades now at $2. "It just kind of puts a dent in your faith in human nature," Lindstrom said. Another investor in Northern California, a 45-year-old commercial property manager, said he lost $320,000 betting on Jiayud. A Missouri investor lost $54,000. He said he believed Meta Platforms, which owns Facebook, would block stock scams from advertising. Meta said it's experimenting with new tools such as facial recognition technology designed to block complex scams. Addressing this crime requires collaboration between banks, governments, law enforcement, and telecoms, a spokeswoman said. Lindstrom and the others formed a support group of about 96 Jiayud investors in the U.S. and other countries who collectively lost about $9 million, he said. Making it harder. NASDAQ says it's made it harder in recent years for risky companies to remain listed on its exchange. In January, NASDAQ accelerated the process for delisting some companies whose share price falls under $1. NASDAQ takes its regulatory responsibilities seriously, it said in a statement. Where NASDAQ does not have principal authority, such as cross-market trading activity, we proactively work with other regulators and enforcement agencies to help address instances of market manipulation. Authorities recently focused on suspicious trading in the shares of several other China-based companies, including Liaxiang and NetClass Technology, according to people familiar with the matter. A spokesman for NetClass said the company can't explain recent volatility in its share price, but is committed to providing investors with information they need to assess the company's performance and future outlook. NetGlass went public in December, pricing its shares at $5 and raising about $10 million, according to securities filings. The share price rose steadily until early May, when it reached an intraday peak of $51 on a frenzy of trading. The price collapsed a few days later. It now trades just above $2. And that's Chinese stock scams lure investors. Our next is a series of articles under the headline, High U.S. Debt Load is the Talk of Wall Street. Growing federal debt is threatening to drive up borrowing costs for Americans. Some of the biggest names in finance are speaking in increasingly alarmed tones about an issue that's bothered investors for decades, the U.S. government's outsized debt load. Ray Dalio, founder of the hedge fund Bridgewater Associates, has warned of a debt crisis akin to an economic heart attack. Jamie Dimon, chief executive of J.P. Morgan Chase, is predicting a breakdown in financial markets. Here's a look at how the government borrows and what it means for markets and the economies. A mismatch between spending and revenue. The government has to borrow money for a simple reason. It spends more money than it collects in revenue. Borrowing fills that gap, ensuring that the government can make the payments required by current law. Adding it all up, outstanding treasuries totaled nearly $29 trillion at the end of May, equivalent to around 95% of annual U.S. economic output and roughly double the amount outstanding 8 years ago. The government is constantly issuing and paying down huge amounts of bills, but the bulk of its outstanding debt carries longer maturities. Anxiety over demand. Worries about deficits are being exacerbated by concern about demand for U.S. debt, particularly whether President Trump's tariff policies could lead in various ways to reduce foreign appetite for treasuries. In fact, the share of treasuries held by foreign investors, including both public and private sector buyers, has been declining for years. Hedge funds, counted as households in Fed records, have helped pick up the slack, but they're seen as a less stable source of funding because they typically buy treasuries using large amounts of borrowed money. That means they occasionally dump bonds during times of market stress, making those situations even worse. The life of a treasury. After a government bond is issued, it trades in the secondary market. The 10-year notes, whose price is charted, were sold on August the 7th of last year at around 99.3 cents on the dollar, offering an annual interest rate of 3.875%. Since then, their price has declined, increasing their yield or expected annual return. That's because investors who buy the security at a lower price earn additional capital gains if they hold them to maturity when they're paid back at 100 cents on the dollar. The mechanics of borrowing. The government does the bulk of its borrowing by issuing securities known as treasuries. Investors can buy directly from the government or purchase and sell in the secondary market. The government also issues savings bonds to individuals and non-marketable debt to federal trust funds, including Social Security trust funds. The government raises money by auctioning off trillions of dollars of treasuries each month, while also paying down trillions of dollars of debt that's coming due. Debt is identified by its maturity. Bills mature in 1 year or less. Notes mature in 2 to 10 years. Bonds mature in 20 or 30 years. A benchmark for everything. The yields on treasuries set a baseline on borrowing costs across the economy, because the U.S. government, for all its challenges, is still seen as the safest borrower around. The yield on the 10-year note, in particular, is a major determinant of 30-year mortgage rates. Why deficits matter? Treasury yields are heavily influenced by the economic outlook and investors' expectations for short-term rates set by the Federal Reserve. One reason that prices have fallen and yields have climbed since last summer is that the unemployment rate has stabilized and investors are now anticipating fewer interest rate cuts from the Fed. Investors are also concerned that the sheer volume of coming Treasury issuance could outstrip demand and push yields higher, regardless of what the economy is doing. Investors are accustomed to surging deficits during wars and recessions. Right now, the government is borrowing as if it were in a crisis, even though it isn't. That points to a structural fiscal imbalance that could require the government to keep issuing larger and larger amounts of notes and bonds. And that's high U.S. debt load is the talk of Wall Street. Our next article is from the Heard on the Street section of the Wall Street Journal and is by Gunjan Banerjee. Political preferences increasingly shape investors' stock portfolios. An adage on Wall Street holds that it's unwise to play politics with your portfolio. Americans are increasingly doing just that. A Gallup poll this spring showed that Democrats who expected stocks to tumble over the next 6 months exceeded Republicans by 59 percentage points. Republicans expecting stocks to climb over that period topped Democrats by 47 percentage points. That optimism gap is translating into trading decisions. David Sadkin, partner at Bel Air Investment Advisors, who oversees around $12 billion in assets for wealthy individuals, said that has become clear in calls he's received from clients since President Trump's tariffs roiled markets this spring. One wealthy couple who weren't fans of Trump's policies asked Sadkin about moving all assets abroad, fearful that American assets from U.S. stocks to bonds to the dollar would tank on the president's watch. If I know how people voted, I could tell you how they feel about the stock market, Sadkin said. The party affiliations of Americans have long shaped how they feel about the economy or the price of eggs and milk at the grocery store. As people give lower marks when their party is out of power, the perception gap started growing much wider after the election of Donald Trump in 2016, according to a monthly consumer survey conducted by the University of Michigan. The 47-point gap in partisan optimism regarding the stock market's trajectory is the largest divide observed in Gallup data provided to the Wall Street Journal going back to 2001. That year, during George W. Bush's presidency, the optimism gap between Republicans and Democrats stood at 13 percentage points. Increasingly, people are peering at their investment portfolios through their red and blue goggles. A group of researchers in a study analyzed security filings for local independent investment advisors in 309 U.S. counties and found that wealthy people who lean Democratic or Republican are choosing different stocks. The divide between their portfolios emerged in 2013 when Barack Obama was president and kept growing through 2019 during Trump's first term, according to Elena Piculina, one of the study's authors. One investor who voted for Trump and isn't too concerned about the vote tariff turmoil is Bruce Beston, a 68-year-old restaurant owner in Louisville, Kentucky. He said media hype about how tariffs would pummel the economy, created buying opportunities for him during the big market swoon in April when he picked up stocks, including Nvidia. Wall Street is finding ways to capitalize on investors' partisanship. Trump Media and Technology Group, the media company tied to the president, launched investments giving individuals access to non-woke companies. Funds including the American Conservative Values ETF and Point Bridge America First ETF, which goes by the ticker MAGA, have drawn tens of millions of dollars in assets. The Conservative Values ETF has roughly tracked the S&P 500's performance over the past 3 years. The MAGA fund has lagged behind the S&P 500 by more than 20 percentage points. At the same time, those who sold at the height of April's tariff turmoil would have missed out on recovering their losses when stocks staged a full recovery. The S&P 500 is now back near record, showing why buying and selling based on political leanings can be disastrous for portfolios. Investing $1,000 upon President Dwight Eisenhower's inauguration in 1953 and holding only when a Republican was president would produce about $29,000 today, according to Paul Hickey at Bespoke Investment Group. The same sum held only during subsequent Democrat administrations would be worth more than double that. Simply buying and holding would have yielded around $1.9 million. That offers only so much comfort to those who remain nervous about the fallout from Trump's rapid shifts in policy. Eknath Belbase in Ithaca, New York, started moving more of his money internationally, worried about high valuations in the U.S. The president's spat with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the Oval Office led him to rethink America's relationship with the rest of the world. The 54-year-old said he's trimmed his U.S. exposure to around 50% of his stock holdings. They're making the game plan up as they go along, he said. Some investors said doing nothing might still be the best move, whatever one's political leanings. Ronald Gallagher, an 81-year-old retiree in Paradise Valley, Arizona, voted for Trump and thinks stocks will likely do better under his administration than they would have if Kamala Harris had won. But he stayed the course during the Biden administration, and the past 2 years were good for his portfolio. Even if he doesn't think Biden deserves the credit for stocks' back-to-back gains of more than 20%, the best showing in a quarter century. They were okay, Gallagher said of the returns. It wasn't through Biden. And that's Political Preferences Increasingly Shape Investors' Stock Portfolio, an article from the Herd on the Street section of the Wall Street Journal. You've been listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming streaming on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org. Or you can listen on the Sun Sounds of Arizona app by downloading it from the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And finally, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot or Echo.